You're listening to the Cannabis Investing Network. Before we begin, a short disclaimer. The full disclaimer follows at the end of this episode. This podcast is a general communication and is being provided for entertainment and information purposes only. It is educational in nature and is not designed to be a recommendation for any specific investment strategy, plan, feature, or other purpose. Please enjoy responsibly. Hello and welcome back to the Cannabis Investing Network podcast. My name is Manish, and today we have the pleasure of being joined by the man who was the runner-up to perform at the Super Bowl halftime show. His name is Abby.
What's going on, man? What's going on? It was tough losing out to Rihanna, but hey, you know, it had to be done.
Well, I'm just sad that the world didn't get to experience your belly dancing performance.
Oh, man. Yeah. No, I mean, look, listen, there's always next year, right? They can wait at the edge of their seats. I'm going to put on an even a bigger show.
There you go.
Things are good. Yeah.
There you go. So, Abby, how are you?
I'm good. I mean, you know, it's a fairly warm February for us over here. I mean, we just came off a cold front, so I can't complain on that front. On the market side, I mean, you know, things are what they are. So I can't complain. What about you?
Well, listen, things are absolutely percolating in the markets. You know, 2 weeks ago, we talked about how a relative calm had set in and, you know, froth was back in the market. And for the last 2 weeks, I mean, that has really just continued. It has been, I think, really back to a risk-on mentality. You have seen activity pick up in almost all sectors. Housing, hearing anecdotal stories about bidding wars back again in Toronto. We're seeing individually, stock by stock, if a stock gets some good news behind it, it's getting a lot of tailwinds and getting priced upwards. And, you know, even cannabis has seen some love in the last few days. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's driven by, you know, this story of Anson Funds, who is a short seller previously, saying that they're now long on cannabis. Maybe it was, you know, hearing about Twitter's new policy that's allowing cannabis advertising. But, you know, it remains that good news is being rewarded again in the markets. And people are definitely more optimistic than they were a few months ago.
Which is, I mean, maybe not a few months ago, because that would bring us into late December, but a few weeks ago for sure, right? Or mid-January, whatever. They are definitely way more optimistic for cannabis, like specifically that I'm talking about. But
right.
Yeah.
I think in general, if you go back to sort of December, it was a very consensus view of very negative, right? Things are not good and they're going to get worse. And I think that's
except for cannabis, because we were all hoping for some sort of legislation to pass. Remember that big rally that we got,
right,
had going in?
Yeah, sorry, good point. That's a fair point. Cannabis, because of how December played out, was a little bit different than everything else. But to start the year, you know, cannabis aside, things have had a really rocking start to the year. And cannabis is now a lagging beneficiary of that, right? It's getting some love on the tail end. And I think what's kind of left for people to discuss and think about is, you know, what does this mean? How long will it last? And, you know, how do you not get caught offside, right, on the upside and the downside of something like this? And so the theme of today is really just, you know, sharing kind of my thesis on where we are, is that I think it takes time and it will be a process to disrupt investor mentality and consumer mentality. And if you look at where we are today, I think there needs to be a lot more work done, which I think will have to happen throughout the year, to get people to readjust their expectations and their mentality with regards to investing and spending. And that process has started, but I think actually we took a step backwards in the last 60 days.
Yeah, I could see that. And one of the biggest indicators is just what you and I were talking about earlier, is that on the capital market side, deal flow activity on the private side has started to pick up. You know, I've been getting some inbound calls, which is weird, because I didn't even know my phone had a ringtone. It's been quiet for so long. And then, you know what? The funny thing was, I did even see a couple alternative crypto coins, altcoins launch, which just a couple people that I had known just asked me if I wanted to invest in them or if I, you know, read their white papers, et cetera, which I found pretty odd because I was like, hey, there is still a lot of risk in the market, or at least I think there's still a lot of risk in the market. Mm-hmm. It kind of seems that people are, just like you said, right, they're coming out of the woodwork and they can't sit idly by on cash, and so they want to do something with it.
Well, look, I think there's a couple things going on, right? I mean, one, to hear this narrative from the Fed itself about disinflation, right, which sounds a lot like deflation, but it's different. But it's the idea being that, you know, inflation was a raging forest fire last year, and they really waited too long, and it started to get out of control. And so they've dumped a ton of water on that thing. And the metaphor breaks apart a little bit because there's this lag effect of, you know, some of the water is on the way. Like, we haven't, you know, felt the full effect of it yet. But how I look at it now is, you know, they've done a good job of helping to slow down inflation and bring down the rate at which things are going up. But I think the risk now is that the flames that are left are going to kind of reignite, right? If they're not completely stamped out. And I think that's what we're seeing. And again, just anecdotally, on the property management side, when employees come up for renewal, what we're seeing is that people who were offered, you know, 5% raises were able to successfully negotiate to get 10 to 15% raises, right? I mean, that is substantial. But it just kind of shows you where the market is at for those things that I call real jobs, right? The mm-hmm. jobs that really require in-person effort and are not glamorous and don't involve sitting behind a computer. You know, labor is still really tight, and that's kind of what the Fed keeps repeating. And that's the part that is kind of hard for them to speak openly about because it's so political. Nobody ever wants to talk about causing people to lose jobs, right? That is a very negative thing, especially now as you're ramping up for the 2024 presidential election. Mm-hmm. But the reality is they need to have some slack in the labor market. They need to have people more willing, you know, to take a job and not demand, you know, 10 or 15% pay increases, because that ultimately is what's going to help stop the inflation process. And it doesn't seem like that has really kicked in yet.
And funny you mentioned that. So, you know, talking about real jobs over here, where, you know, and we're using that as in person. One of my friends, he owns a restaurant in Toronto. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're opening up. It's going to be a really nice like restaurant out there. And so he's hiring staff, and he has another restaurant already in the city. And so he's bringing some staff in. And they've hired a couple of recruiters to kind of bring some more staff in, like servers, waitresses, waiters, hostesses, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And he's actually offering his existing employees a referral program, saying, hey, if you put me in front of somebody who we end up hiring, you're going to get $150. Hmm. Right. And like, that's how bad it is for a restaurant. I mean, he is expanding, which is great to hear. Mm-hmm. But like, even now, it's still really difficult to get people in these jobs.
And so part of, you know, the thesis of today, what we're talking about is that it's hard to change people's mentality, especially when you've gone through something so extreme recently. And what employers went through recently was this scarcity of labor and how hard it was to find people. So they really don't want to lose the people they have, right? And if you look at 2022, I think that a lot of companies experienced peak earnings in 2022, meaning that they got the benefit of inflation. They got to pass along price increases to their mm-hmm. consumers, but they were able to keep a lid on expenses for the most part, right? So wage growth is still catching up. You know, when we talk about in the real estate space, you know, construction cost, and, you know, since last year, people have been theorizing that, hey, construction cost is going to come down, you know, as the Fed increases rates. Well, material costs, good costs, have come down, right? Lumber has basically round-tripped to where it was pre-pandemic. I think steel and concrete are seeing some decreases, but labor cost is the other way around. Wages are actually still catching up. So people are, you know, you're able to push off the wage increase conversation until, you know, whenever you typically get a raise. So those numbers are still going up, right? So we have not seen the cost of construction crack at all. And that is, you know, a key component to bringing down the cost of housing long term, right? So all of this is to say that this really is going to be a process. If you look at since the beginning of the year, bonds, so the, you know, the cost of money really fell to begin the year and fell pretty precipitously. And that was kind of in line with the idea that, hey, we're winning the war on inflation. And they have in the last, you know, 10 days gone completely the other way. The sort of relief in bonds that we've seen has been completely wiped out. And now bonds are basically as high as they were any point in the last year, including those really scary parts of June, July, and September, October. So all this is to say that although we're in a period of calm right now, I am, you know, maybe as negative as I ever have been that we're preparing to go through the windshield. And in fact, the rally that we've had and the amount that conditions have eased in the last few weeks actually sets us up very negatively to deal with that change. Because at the end of the year, at least everybody was negative, right? And they were sort of bracing for impact. Now it's sort of a mixed bag where, you know, some people have gotten bullish again. Some people have gotten long again. And that's where you can really, you know, get hurt, because typically we see things go up in an escalator kind of slowly and down in an elevator. Right. And certainly we felt that in our industry after SAFE failed. That was a really quick elevator ride down.
It was drop zone.
It was drop zone. That's right. We weren't sure if this elevator had any brakes, really. Exactly, what was happening. So, and one of the things I forgot to point out last episode, you know, people often will say to us, hey, you're spending a lot of time talking about the macro, right? And this is a cannabis investing podcast. Well, you have to know what's going on around you, especially when you're investing in a speculative asset class. And one of the big, big reasons the macro is so important to cannabis investors is that, you know, the 1,000-pound gorilla in our industry is the ETF MSOS. And whenever fear spikes up on the macro side and the VIX spikes and you're seeing people sell, that's the when we've been seeing MSOS get their first redemptions, which is really a pretty new phenomenon for us. And those redemptions in MSOS translate to the ETF doing forced selling, right? And that forced selling is going to be the cause of the most pain in this industry, because it shows us where short-term support really is. And just like on the way up, how it caused these crazy price spikes at the end of the day, we're now going to see that the opposite way. Right. And so it crams through the selling, you know, forced amount of selling in a day, depending on how much they tell their broker to sell. And this is very painful psychologically. And once this gets going again, if it gets going again, then it causes really extreme pain to the downside. It causes really negative psychology for the investors. And there really becomes a self-fulfilling cycle, right? Where it pushes things down, and then other people just naturally want to sell or get out of the way. And again, if you think the macro will get a lot worse, which I personally do, then this causes a very negative feedback loop with MSOS. So if you don't care anything at all about the macro environment otherwise, that is a huge reason why you have to pay attention to it.
For sure. And then the other thing in terms of volatility for MSOS is that it's typically very thinly traded right now. Like there isn't an abundance of capital kind of coming in. So when you do even have small movements in it, it, you know, you've got that volatility. Now amplify that for when you add in negative sentiment, add in whatever, any some sort of catalyst that points to the downside, it does come down quite a bit. I mean, the flip side of that, let's not be too pessimistic over here. The flip side of that is that it also does get amplified on the upside, right?
Totally.
When sentiment starts changing, MSOS starts rallying, and then obviously all that money trickles down. We're not there right now, unfortunately. But we did see that in December, right?
Yeah, 100%.
Pop up. And that's, again, it's a very – so you hit it on the head. The macro is extremely important, especially for investing in any speculative asset classes. You know, I think who was it? It was Alan Brockstein who uses the casino analogy, right? It's like, hey, like we're just one game at the table in the casino.
Yes.
We're leaving the casino. You got to sort of every now and then you got to, you know, put your cards down and look around the other tables and see who's still there, right?
Yes, that's a great point. That's a phenomenal point. Bringing back an old analogy from AB, and to talk about that liquidity mismatch, right? You're not supposed to have this. You're not supposed to have an ETF that is more liquid than its underlying components. And to give you an example of kind of where that's playing out in the broader market is Blackstone REIT. So BREIT, as it's called, I don't think I've ever talked about this on here, but that was a big news story in Q4 of last year because BREIT was getting a lot of redemptions. And they have a mechanism whereby they gate redemptions. So I think it's like 2%. Of their AUM, they will allow to redeem every quarter, right? So 8% over a year. And they had a lineup of people wanting to get their money out. And this was kind of a sign that, hey, real estate is going to face some pressure. And so a couple of people have asked me about my opinion on it. And there's a couple things I think that are going on, right? And one is that when in good times, a lot of these things behave like black boxes. And people don't really think about how they work mechanistically. So the fact that you have this sort of public or liquid vehicle, right, called BREIT that you can put your money into and whenever you want, you can take your money out, mm-hmm. that doesn't really make sense because the vehicle, the fund, owns commercial real estate, which is semi-illiquid, right? You can't just turn around and snap your fingers and sell these assets to pull your money out. Mm-hmm. So there's a liquidity mismatch that was going on where in the good times, it didn't matter because people were rushing to throw their money into these things. So there was actually a pileup of capital inside of there. And if you wanted your money out, it was like, great, here you go. You know, you're helping us solve a problem we have of too much cash sitting around. Mm-hmm. But now on the way down, people go, I want my money out of this thing, and they have to wait in line. And what does the REIT do? You know, do they suddenly fire sale a bunch of assets to, you know, help people who are nervous and want to get out? Absolutely not. They say, okay, you have to wait, and when we have the opportunity, you know, we will get you your capital back. Mm-hmm. Now the flip side of that is that part of the reason people are rushing to get their money out of BREIT is that there's no second-to-second accounting of this stuff. And this the NAV or net asset value or the price of this fund is based on how they decide to market every month. So because it's privately marked, they have to decide and say, we were worth 100 yesterday mm-hmm. and we're worth 98 today. Right. And so obviously it's a very subjective process. And the problem is that if you look at from, you know, the last year, how much they have moved their marks, it's not a whole lot. So when you look a lot across your portfolio and you say, hey, I own publicly traded REITs, they're down 40%, but I own this privately traded REIT and it's down 4%. You go, well, that's what I'm going to sell, right? That's where I'm going to raise liquidity because I'm only down 4%. I don't know what the number is, but I'm only down. It's a very small amount that they've marked it down. So that's a big part of the problem. And to their credit, one of the issues is that there has not been a lot of comparable transaction sales in commercial real estate with depressed values, right? I mean, they have to mark these assets by getting appraisals. And appraisers are supposed to deem the value of the asset today based on comparables or what is actually traded. Well, mm-hmm. in the private markets, like there has not been a lot of distressed sales. I would say barely any. And values have not really moved a whole lot. So what are they supposed to do? Just preemptively assume that their value is down 10, 20, 30% when they don't have the comparables to support it, right? So that's the other problem here. There's, I think, a issue in valuing the marks. Certainly, if you compare them to public marks, there's a large discrepancy. But, you know, unless they're just supposed to kind of make these things out of thin air and do them with conjecture, then, you know, they are following the correct process.
And you raise a good point there. For B-REIT, obviously, it was a massive example. But you know that underlying issue that you talked about, just not the instrument or the vehicle that you're investing in having more liquidity than the actual underlying assets, that problem runs into liquid alts as well. So liquid alternatives, which is basically private equity funds that are, you know, that you can, that retail people can invest in, where you can get liquidity in, you know, 3 or 4 days as opposed to once a quarter, right? It's funny because I was my parents, they have some in their portfolio, they've got some liquid alts, and they mark to market every quarter. And so, you know, whenever my mom, she always looks at her portfolio and she says, oh, well, you know, this one's not down as much as these ones. So maybe we should keep buying this one. Very similar to the example. But, and then I try to explain to her about mark to market and how, you know, it gets done. And she's like, oh, okay, well, why don't they just mark it up all the time? I was like, well, you can't do that. But it's really interesting to kind of see that play out. And I never actually drew the parallel to MSOS with that. So good on you for doing that.
Well, that's what we do here. We stretch and draw comparisons. So whether or not,
hey, look, OTC listed companies are technically private companies, right? I've faced that argument multiple times with people.
Well, they're definitely not technically private companies. They're definitely technically public companies.
They are public companies. That's my stance on them. But a lot of people say, well, you can't get liquidity, and you know you'll move the market so much, so you should look at them as private investments until they uplist.
Sure, you could think about them that way, but they definitely are public companies.
They're public companies. No, I agree.
And so just one last point on that is, when you talk about kind of how slowly investor mentality moves, but ultimately what gets things to change, what actually causes long-term change in how people think about things, there's a REIT, I think it's a Brookfield REIT that is in LA, and they own, I think, only office product in downtown LA. So it's a very specialized REIT. And I just read recently, I think this week, that they are doing strategic default on one of their office towers. So what does that mean? That basically means they said, we're not paying our mortgage. And because of the way REITs structure these mortgages, they typically do non-recourse loans, meaning when the lender gives you a mortgage, their recourse is only on that asset. They may own 100 assets in their portfolio, but the lender can only come after that one asset that they're lending on. Mm-hmm. So there's no corporate or personal guarantees, meaning that in the case of this asset, obviously the office market has been going through a serious transition. Nobody knows where it's going to land. The REIT is deciding that, hey, based on the amount of debt we have here, it's probably better for us to default on our payments and put the lender in a tough spot. And the lender has to decide, okay, do I want to foreclose on this asset and take it back? Well, A, maybe they're not equipped to handle, you know, the management of this property. Mm-hmm. B, maybe they're looking at it and saying, yeah, well, you know, if we take it back, we're actually over-levered here. You know, maybe we have 75% of yesterday's value and maybe today's value is not the same, mm-hmm. right? They're thinking, well, you know what? Maybe we're just going to give these guys some time and some breathing room. Okay, they're not going to make their payments in the meantime, but maybe things will get better, right? And maybe we're better off having it in their hands than us taking the keys back right now. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that's the game that's being played. But you better believe that other lenders will look at this and say, look, if you want us to lend on these office assets, well, either we need to be way more conservative in our underwriting, or we need to take recourse from you, or we need to take some additional security so we do not end up in this kind of situation, mm-hmm. right? And these are the kind of actions that cause lenders to rethink at how they look at lending on particular assets and probably lending in general, and right. It causes long-term shifts in behavior. And again, to draw this back to cannabis, how long until you start to see cannabis operators have strategic defaults? Right? How long until you see people say, hey, IIPR, you know what? I'm not going to pay for your facility over here, right? Because I'm not really using this facility. Or my rental rate is not making any sense in a market like Nevada or Arizona, where mm-hmm. these facilities are really not worth anything anymore, right? And so one of the things that was interesting when IIPR had their big press release, that was a really negative press release about how they're using customer security deposits to fill holes. That's a very bad sign, by the way. One of the things that was in that press release is that they renegotiated some leases to have cross default clauses. So what they're doing is they're thinking ahead and saying, okay, we're worried that this customer might walk on facility A. So we gave them some kind of carrot, right? Whether that's deferred payments or whether that's lower lease rate or whatever, but we've included now a cross default clause that if they default on any of their facilities, that constitutes a default across all of their facilities, right? So they're already looking ahead and being worried about strategic default.
Right. And why don't they do that right off the get-go? Is that just because there's you know, other people who can lend against it? Like that, you know, if I was, let's say, a cannabis operator and I was going to IIPR, obviously I would want a non-recourse clause in the lease. But if you were IIPR or a lender, why would you allow that to happen?
Well, there's a couple of reasons, right? I'd say the number one reason is just competition. And that's what happens when you're in a risk-on mentality, right?
But particularly in cannabis, like there really isn't that much competition. There's only like two or three, you know, big commercial cannabis REITs.
Yeah, but there, I would say for sale leaseback, there actually, at least historically, was a lot of competition.
Yeah. Gotcha.
Like you know, they're publicly, you know, there's NewLake and there's IIPR and Power REIT, which I think is in a different, doing all kinds of wacky stuff on their own. Mm-hmm. But privately too, let's not forget, there is a really big market of private investors who kind of look at these super high cap rate deals and will bid on them. Right. So the public REITs are not the only game in town.
Gotcha. Okay.
And in fact, there was one deal I remember talking to an operator about, and they insisted that they would not, they were offering their property for sale leaseback, but they insisted they would not do it with a public REIT. And I said, okay, why? Right? Because public REITs have the lowest cost of capital typically. But they said, look, if I ever hit a bump in the road, I need to have an owner who will give me flexibility. I need to have somebody I can sit down with and have a negotiation with. Right. And I just know if it's a public company, they're going to be less incentivized to do so, right? Because if they give me flexibility, then other people will ask for it. So I thought I thought that was a really interesting perspective.
It's a very forward-thinking entrepreneur.
Well, so just to think for a second about cannabis debt, you know, a lot of the debt holders can't own the equity.
Yes. Right? And
so again, like how long until some of these cannabis operators start doing strategic default and saying, well, okay, go ahead and take the keys to the place. Oh, right. You can't. Right. So companies that are overlevered, and for the most part, this excludes most of the big companies, but companies that are overlevered, this is going to start to be an issue. And again, in today's market, I don't think we're seeing it very much. But if things get worse, then that could be something we start to see.
Yeah, it's interesting. I never even considered the non-recourse clause, or I guess why would I, right? We're always in a frothy market. Stocks only went up.
Yeah, so far been pretty good. So, okay, moving on. Actually, one thing I wanted to say, which is a correction from last episode. At the end of the episode, I was talking about the California interstate developments, and I mistakenly said the California AG asked the federal government for direction. But actually, I read a little more into it and I was wrong. Actually, what happened is the DCC, which I think is the governing body in California for cannabis, they asked California's attorney general for permission. So I think actually that's positive because it's a lot easier, I think, to get a response from the California AG than the federal AG. But it's still like, you know, even assuming the California AG responds positively to this, I don't think it's going to be the simple, quick fix that everybody thinks it is. And there's a great article that I will link to from Bloomberg where they talk a little bit about this. And some of the problems just include the fact that it's still going to be very illegal to ship cannabis legally through any of the middle states, right? To ship it by truck through a state that does not allow recreational cannabis, that probably will represent a pretty large risk. And what that means is that would just create sort of a trading block potentially between Oregon, Arizona, California, and Washington state. And that doesn't really help California. In fact, prices in Oregon are even lower than they are in California, right? Mm-hmm. So California has its eye on those, you know, juicy New Jersey, you know, and you know, maybe New York or maybe Florida type markets, but you know, it doesn't really work that way. If you're going to ship over there, and first of all, those states are probably not going to allow it. But secondly, there's other states in your neighborhood who have even a lower cost, who maybe want to get into your state. So I don't think it's the panacea that people think it is. And I took out this quote from the article that I thought was pretty good. It's from Tiffany Devitt of Groundwork. And she was referring to the idea that, you know, California is trying to solve its problems by exporting its problems to other states. Mm-hmm. And she said, if your house is burning down, you don't invite someone over for dinner. You put out the fire first. Damn. Well said. And look, the reality is California doesn't really have the stomach to look inwards and fix its own problems. Right? I mean, it fixes its own problems by opening more retail doors and superseding municipal controls. And it also fixes its own problems by enforcing the rules, mm-hmm. which it just doesn't have the stomach to do. So it's trying to get out of this situation by exporting its problems elsewhere. Right? And the reality is interstate commerce in California kind of already exists. There are a host of distributors in the legal market which purchase product from cultivators, and that product in the metric system just quote unquote goes missing, and that product ends up all across the country, especially right now in New York dispensaries.
It also ends up overseas in Thailand. Yeah,
that's right. That's absolutely right. And that's why you're seeing in New York, you know, legitimate California products showing up, right? So that interstate commerce is already happening. It's not like it's a secret in the metric system. It's just the California regulators are turning a blind eye to it because they're like, oh, well, right? I mean, that's helping our local companies. So that stuff is already happening, and there's just no enforcement of it going on because companies are trying to survive, and the DCC is not trying to penalize those companies. But the reality is they know what they have to do. They just don't have the stomach to do it.
Right.
On the other side of the coin, Maryland. There was a great article that the rules in Maryland are moving forward. We talked about it last time. But I just want to point out the quote about regulation that came from the sponsor of the Maryland bill. And the quote is, it's talking about how you know, there's going to be enforcement of the regulations. And some people are, you know, worried about that because they're saying, well, you're locking people up for cannabis, right? Mm-hmm. If they're not following the rules or selling, you know, selling without a license, basically, right? Having illegal dispensaries, et cetera. And this guy goes, this is about regulating business. Without enforcement, these licenses that we're giving out become useless and meaningless because they can't make money. And these minority businesses that we're trying to develop will fail. Boom.
Yeah.
There it is. That is exactly the argument. And people who rail against license caps will say, hey, you don't have license caps in any other industry. And to that I say, you don't have 280E in any other industry either. So I grant you that cannabis should be like every other industry once you remove the barriers to access of 280E and access to capital and uplisting, etc., that caused this to be an extremely punitive industry.
Yeah. And there are other industries with license caps as well, right? Like it's totally. Not just cannabis. Yeah, exactly.
Totally. Casinos. But
sorry, go ahead.
Casinos, alcohol, depending on the jurisdiction. Yeah, and
pretty much any vice industry.
Well, anything that's highly regulated, right? But
right.
People who just argue against license caps, it's like, hey, I take your point, right? And New Jersey, by the way, just removed the canopy license cap. But in New Jersey, for example, the cap was at 37, and there's only 15 grows operating. So the bottleneck is not only just license caps, it's also access to capital and getting through municipal controls. And these are very high hurdles that cause a lot of pain. Mm-hmm. And if you just say, hey, there's no license cap at all, ultimately, because of 280E, these operators can't exist, right? Unless they are, you know, forced to just not pay their taxes or break the rules. So I think this is a really good development for Maryland. I think they're exactly arguing the right point. And I also think that this could end up being a really bright spot for the industry in 2023. If Maryland actually comes online on time, which is supposed to be July 1st, which so far it's looking relatively positive. If that actually happens, I think that would be a really good tailwind for the whole industry.
Hopefully.
Hopefully. Talking as well about kind of the impact of, you know, quasi-unregulated markets, we saw Ayr Wellness sell their Arizona assets, or at least enter into an agreement to sell their Arizona assets. And let's talk about this. So they originally paid $9.6 million of cash for the asset, plus a couple million shares, which at the time were valued at a huge number. And they also took on a seller's note. Okay. Now, when they're selling the asset, they're getting $20 million of cash, so about $10 million more than they originally got. They are netting out on the shares, but the shares are way, way cheaper, like almost, you know, 90 or 95% lower than where they originally sold this thing. And the seller's note is a wash. Mm-hmm. So really the difference basically is the $10 million versus I think the 3.5 million shares they issued in the beginning, right? But so you look at that today and say, well, they originally did a deal for like over 100 million, mm-hmm. and the deal today is a fraction of that, right? But another way of looking at it is that the actual delta in the deal is $10 million of cash that they're getting in the door today for, you know, the I think 3-ish million of shares that they issued. Well, you know what, that values their shares at like $3 a share or something like that. The stock is trading for less than half of that today. Mm-hmm. Right. So ultimately, although it might be a bit embarrassing, I think it actually is a deal that makes a lot of sense. Right.
Well, a lot of people have been saying for Ayr, right? They're spread too thin. So they had too many assets anyways. So,
well, I don't know if that's true necessarily. I think they were spread thin operationally because the company just had a lot of operational challenges. Right. And I think if you look at Arizona, one of the big problems, I think the big problem in Arizona is that there is no seed to sale tracking system, which is kind of mind-boggling. Mm-hmm. So what that means is that if you have somebody who is, you know, little willing to play a little bit loose with the rules, you can get product in from anywhere, right? From California, for example, and that's, you know, illicitly, and suddenly you just enter it into your system, right? I mean, there's no seed to sale tracking. So that's what operators in Arizona will tell you. It's not making sense how much product is floating out there. Mm-hmm. And that's probably what's contributing to these low prices. So Arizona is a market that's really struggling. And I think that's part of the drag that's been on Trulieve's integration with Harvest is that, you know, Harvest was making a lot of money in Arizona. And I think Arizona has had a lot of price compression for that reason. Mm-hmm. So although it's a limited license market on the dispensary side, the fact that there's no seed to sale tracking, I think, just means that anyone who's willing to be unscrupulous in Arizona mm-hmm. kind of has, you know, you've kind of taken the unregulated market and allowed it to operate through the regulated market because there's no tracking system.
Right.
And so that's kind of a concerning thought of mine is like, especially as companies face harder times, there's definitely an incentive for companies to skirt the rules here. And, you know, who's checking, right? Nobody seems to be enforcing it. So, you know, that's a similar kind of pattern of behavior we've heard in Oklahoma, where it's completely unlimited license. And in fact,
and you've got illicit mark, a product coming in.
Well, in Oklahoma, it might be even be the other way around, right? It might be that product is going out of Oklahoma. I think there's a crazy stat, like only a third of the Oklahoma grows have ever been inspected.
Yeah.
Right. Which just shows you how different Oklahoma is from some of these other places, right? The regulators are scrambling to keep up with the system and they're way, way behind. And if Oklahoma goes fully legal through a referendum in March, that problem is going to get a lot worse. Mm-hmm. So we'll see. Now, another really interesting development with Ayr is that the CEO, John Sandelman, basically stepped down, moved to executive chairman, and their new president, who is the guy from Neiman Marcus, he's moved into the CEO role, right? So mm-hmm. I think this is a very positive development for the company. Now, there's two ways to look at this, right? One is that people from outside the industry have not typically done a good job of being CEO. The other way of looking at it is that something was seriously wrong at Ayr, and the way the stock is trading, People are very concerned with the debt load of the company, and it's trading like it could go broke. That's how cheap it is, right? So I think that these movements tell you a couple of things. One, you know, they are seriously moving to rectify the issue, getting rid of over $20 million of debt through seller's notes, bringing in $20 million of cash, right? I mean, any way you look at that, that's positive for the survival of the company. Mm-hmm. Number two, having a financial CEO move to the chairman role and having an operational person move to CEO for a company that's always been weak on operations, I think that's definitely a positive, but too early to tell if it's going to solve their problems.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And so, but I think when you look at it in totality, I go, you know, I'm kind of surprised AirStock has not felt the love, because the only way you can rationalize where they're trading today, I mean, other than just investor fatigue and being fed up with the story, is that, hey, there's something wrong with this company, and they're either going to have massive share dilution to stay alive, or they're not going to be able to stay alive, right? And both of these moves to me are very positive for the survival of the company. And so I think that's something to really keep your eye on. I highlight this as probably one of the most interesting potential risk-reward trades in the industry. That being said, if things get more negative overall and people start looking more at the downside of things, right, which back to my example of that strategic default on those office towers, that's what causes lenders to become more negative and to become more concerned about downside risk. That could ultimately be a big challenge for AIR, right? If people get more worried about downside, then they worry more, you know, they're less interested in companies with huge upside potential. They start to look for companies like GTI that have just an absolutely low amount of debt and good operational cash flow.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, like, listen, you hit it on the head, right? Like, for AIR, it's the operation story has been going on for quite some time. They signaled this a while ago when, I don't know who the CEO right now is, but the Neiman Marcus guy, when he came in, when that press release came out, that kind of signaled that, hey, there were some shakeups happening. And now that this is occurring, they're doing all the right things that the market does want to hear. Even getting rid of that Arizona asset, being more concentrated, focusing on operations, like, those are all positive things going into this. It's just, hey, let's see how it goes and see if it actually works.
Well, exactly. It's a show me story, right? I mean, they have just embarrassed themselves so many times with the guidance, and cut guidance like five times or something. It's a joke, right? I mean, nobody believes their guidance. So it really is important for them to show the market that they can actually, you know, get their costs under control and get closer to operating cash flow positive.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, moving on. Another company actually that has had large layoffs. So Canopy Growth. So Canopy Growth was in the news. They're shutting down the Smith Falls facility, right? So that's the old Hershey's factory. That was in the early days of cannabis.
Yeah.
A huge, huge positive story in terms of, you know, look at how we're going to these far out places, bringing life back into a town that's been deserted and really was hurting. And, you know, cannabis really was that feel good story for the industrial base of a country. Mm-hmm. And Bruce Linton was out there saying, look, this is what other countries are going to latch onto, the ability to go to Germany or, you know, some places in the US and breathe life into places that desperately need jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so I guess the question is why, right? Why is Canopy Growth doing this now? And I think there's a couple of reasons. And the first is that for the last 2 years, there has been tremendous amount of government subsidies flowing to these companies. And I think it would have probably looked bad for them to have all these layoffs when they were also getting government incentives to keep employees in their positions, right? Mm-hmm. So that's one. The second is that the whole market now has gotten religion about cost control. And the capital markets are starting to reward companies for announcing layoffs and getting cost control. And so that's a big part of it, because you remember way back in the day, people would reward you for having these crazy plans of building 1 million square feet, mm-hmm. right? That your funded capacity was what would get you a lot of eyeballs and traction. Well, now the incentives are the other way. And if you can control your cost, you're getting rewarded for it. So the timing of it makes a lot more sense. And lastly, because there are no supply caps in Canada, bigger is not better, right? So it's not about capacity, it's about sell through. How much product can you actually sell to the customer at the end of the day? And because Canada has way too much supply, having a ton of grow is not helpful. Mm-hmm. Also, because Canada has to sell through the provincial channels, the provincial government is under a lot of pressure to not favor these big companies, right? Well, okay, well, this is the result of that now. 800 people in Smith Falls lose their jobs, mm-hmm. right? And just to contrast this to the early days, I remember reading a article in the newspaper in like 2017 or 18 or 19 about a guy who was working as a part-time employee at Canopy doing the pick and pack, right? Like taking the product and putting it in the shipping bag and sending it out to consumers, because back in the day it was direct to consumer for medical. And part of the comp package was options. And the story was that this guy was getting like $14 an hour, but he also got some options. Mm-hmm. He became a millionaire off the options.
Yeah, there's tons of those stories. I remember the receptionist, the first one. I think she ended up making 20 or 30 million. I don't know if she actually ended up making it, but like her stock options were valued around that high. I remember seeing that story too.
Well, and remember that a lot of these options were given at like, you know, $1, $2, $5. This stock peaked around, you know, 65 or something.
Yeah, exactly. At that peak. That's right. It wasn't the receptionist. It was an EA. That's what it was.
Yeah. So, you know, getting coffee for Bruce Linton was a very lucrative gig depending on when you got in.
Yeah. Or when you got out.
Yeah, exactly. And look, lastly, in Canada, that $1 per gram excise tax, it might be worse than 280E because, you know, that dollar per gram excise tax was put in when they were modeling kind of $10 a gram of sale price, right? Well, even at $10 a gram, even if cannabis sold for $10 a gram at the register, you know, if you work that backwards, there's only about $3 or $4 for the cultivator in there out of 10, right? When you take out sales tax and all that kind of stuff, and you know, what the retailer
retail
gets, distribution, exactly. Et cetera, right? So even if they were getting $3 or $4, you know, that $1 a gram excise tax, that's a 25 to 33% tax, right? That's massive, 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 and it comes off the top. You look at Village Farms, which is probably the most impressive production operation in Canada. I mean, they're paying like effectively something like 30 to 40% in that dollar excise tax. So, and for the government, like what's the incentive to ever pull back on that, right? It's very hard to get rid of that. So also what we're seeing is that the province is a roadblock. They're absorbing profits and preventing verticality. And now, you know, the Ontario cannabis store, which is the provincial arm, is saying, well, we're going to lower our margins to help fight the illicit market, which is total nonsense, absolute and utter nonsense. They're lowering their margins because their financials are public and they are the only people in cannabis making money in Canada. Mm-hmm. They're making money hand over fist because they control the game, right? They determine how much they're going to pay you. They determine how much they're going to sell to the retailers for. And so they're able to make a healthy margin, right? And that's money that should be going into the pocket of the retailers or the cultivators and is going into the hands of the government. Mm-hmm. So the government's making out like a bandit. And ultimately, there's nothing really the private companies can do about it.
Yeah, it's a shame. It's a shame, man. Canada was the first G7 countries to legalize, and we're going to be a footnote in the history of cannabis.
Well, maybe, right? Now, the last point on that is, I remember back in the day, I was doing research on the Florida market, and I messaged a guy who had these really good reviews in the Florida medical subreddit. And I messaged him and I introduced myself and I said, hey, I'm an investor. You know, I'd really love to chat with you. I love your reviews. And he messaged me back and he said, hey, thanks for the note, but I actually don't believe in investing when it comes to cannabis. I don't think medicine should ever be sold for a profit. And it's kind of funny when you think about that, because, you know, this guy presumably bought cannabis in the black market you know, his whole life before there was a regulated industry, right? And the illicit market is the probably the only time that people actually made a profit on selling cannabis. The legal market, for the most part, it reminds me of Uber and Lyft, where the consumer has been a huge beneficiary of the fact that these companies were able to go out and raise all this capital, because the pursuit of growth has allowed these companies to not have to worry about profits. And you say to investors, hey, look, don't worry about profitability today. We're building a giant machine, and we have to lose money to get there, right? And the market has rewarded that for years and years and years and years. Mm-hmm. And finally, when you look at Uber and Lyft, that is stopping, right? The companies are saying, look, we can't give out these super low promotions anymore, and we have to raise prices on the consumer so we can actually make some money. And so it's just funny because there's so much hate towards companies like Trulieve when in fact, and Curaleaf, for example, when in fact a lot of these companies have been operating at a loss for so long because of the fact that they're able to be funded through capital raises and debt for on the prospect of growth. Right. And those two companies in particular, Trulieve and Curaleaf, have both given guidance to the market that they're going to generate free cash flow this year. Okay. Not operating cash flow, but free cash flow.
Which is huge.
Which is huge if it happens, right? Yeah. That's where it's really a show me story, not a tell me story. I think Curaleaf guided to like over $100 million of free cash flow, which I have huge doubts about. Like if they can actually pull that off, it will be a gigantic reversal. It will be really, really good for the industry if they manage to do that. I don't know if Trulieve has guided to the number on free cash flow. I think they've just said positive free cash flow, right? So essentially break even or maybe a little bit positive. But anecdotally, there was a post just the other day that they fired an entire call center in Florida.
Right? Well, that's how they get to free cash flow.
Well, that's what I'm saying. They probably outsourced it to India or the Philippines. Right. Yeah. They're not getting rid of support. They're just outsourcing it. Right. So these are the kind of drastic measures. It's not fun. It's not nice. But these are the kind of things it takes to get to turn around your bottom line. Right. And these are the kind of tough decisions that companies have to make now and really tighten their belt in order to get there.
Right. Right.
So I think you're going to see more of this. I also think that you're going to see companies right sizing cultivation operations where, okay, yeah, maybe we did build 100,000 feet in mass, but that's not doing us any favors anymore. So if we have to mothball half of the facility and only operate, you know, in half of the facility, you know, with half the staff or less, that's what we have to do. Right? So that's a big theme for 2023. And I think that will be very positively rewarded if these companies can actually get expenses under control.
Yeah, I mean, if they can get free cash flow, that's a game changer for sure, right? Especially for the big four or big five or whatever you want to call them now. But my question to you kind of is this, right? Let's say this ends up happening, because if Curaleaf getting free cash flow, and let's say Trulieve getting free cash flow as well, that signals to the market that, okay, something is working in cannabis, right? These companies are actually being able to do to do it. They get re-rated, whatever. You know, who's next? Who's outside of the big MSOs? Like, where's the delta or the alpha going to come from on the small cap, like single state operators? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
like,
sure. So
yeah, let's go outside of the sidelines.
Yeah. So let me take this opportunity to give a shout out to the Cannabis Investing Podcast, which is Rena Sherbel's podcast at Seeking Alpha. And they've done it actually the last 2 weeks, I think, really good episodes. So one was with Alan Brockstein and one was with Nick Gastevich. And those are both, you know, people I have a lot of time for. And they really dug into, hey, what are some interesting opportunities? And so Alan last week talked specifically about AIR, Ascend, and Columbia Care. Okay. So I think AIR and Ascend are the most obvious beneficiaries at the next level down. So if Trulieve and Curaleaf can demonstrate cash flow positivity, then I think it bodes well for other operators that they can also get there. Now, I think they still have to prove it, but I think it bodes like really, really well for those companies because they trade at relatively cheap EV to EBITDA multiples. The problem is EBITDA doesn't mean anything if it doesn't translate to cash flow.
Right.
Right. So that's the struggle. Now, Columbia Care, I have to say, I really do disagree. I think Columbia Care lacks the operational chops. I think that you've seen, you've seen John Sandelman step down. You saw actually Kyle Kingsley at Vireo step down now. And I think Nick Vita's next on the list, right? If that acquisition fails, then I think you'll see there has to be a shakeup at that company too. And no disrespect to any of these people, because there was a time and place at which they were what these companies needed, you know, to be the founding member and get it to where it is. Mm-hmm. But now these are operational stories, and now cash flow is king. And so to me, Columbia Care is in a very bad position if they can't get this deal closed. Now, that being said, I actually think Cresco is not in a great position either. So that's why I think both these companies are kind of tight at the hip here, and they will do whatever they have to do to get it closed. Mm-hmm. If that means they take a bath on closing their acquisitions, so be it, right? If that means the deal gets retraded, which is, I guess, what the market is telling you, that the deal might get retraded and Columbia Care might get a worse deal, so mm-hmm. be it, right? But I actually do think the deal will go through because it's beneficial to both companies. But if it doesn't go through, I would be very worried about Columbia Care. Air, if they can show that they have operationally turned a corner, that will be good for them. I think Ascend is on the way, right? I mean, I think they've done a lot of right things, and I think that the Maryland deal is very positive for them as well. So I think Ascend has a lot going for it. I own a lot of Ascend, to be fair. I own a lot of Air too, but you know, it's not worth nearly what it used to be, so it's a lot more painful. But yeah. Those I think would be the biggest beneficiaries. Last point on that is, people have been relatively negative on cannabis, and the sort of reflation, quote unquote, that we've seen in other markets, like tech. You know, if you look at tech, the companies that were not operationally cash flow positive really got punished. And even a company like Meta, which used to be cash flow positive and then got, you know, hammered in the third quarter, that really started to get knocked on, despite the fact that it had a big cash balance, right? Mm-hmm. So there was just a lot of negativity. That has gone completely the other way. And funny enough, Alan said that he's now short Meta. So I thought that was a just kind of funny parallel thinking. But and I agree with him, by the way. I think it's totally overdone. But I think that you know, when things are bad and people are worried, they look at how much, you know, what they look at operational cash flow and they look at debt and they start to get worried about those things. So that's where we are with cannabis, right? Ascend and Air have large debt loads relative to their enterprise value and relative to the fact that they don't have operating cash flow. Well, when things get better, people don't worry as much about that, right? Because there's less default risk. You know, your equity value improves and you can raise equity. So that's not where we are in cannabis, right? But over time, I think we'll get back there. But the key thing is demonstrating that you can make progress on your operational cash flow.
Yeah. And see, like, even just hearing that, like, that gets me excited, especially for cannabis, right?
Mm-hmm. So on that note, one company that I'm going to spend some time, I'm going to really dig into, and I'm going to share kind of my analysis as I get there, is Shopify. So Shopify is really interesting because Shopify actually runs the online store for the Ontario Cannabis Store. And so far, they can't do it for, you know, the U.S. market because it's federally illegal. But it's a super interesting company, you know, massive amount of scale, not operationally cash flow positive, but not tremendous amount of burn either. Something like, you know, $150 million a quarter. For the year, actually, I think it was, they burned something like $100 million or $200 million. You know, they've got like, I think $3 billion of cash. So it's something to keep an eye on because it's 75% off of the lows, by the way. Like, so up 75% from Q3, which just shows you how much the market's rebounded. But very cash-rich company, operationally cash flow negative, but not hugely so, and has the ability to derive a lot more business from cannabis once it's federally permissible. So that's just mm-hmm. company I'm going to be putting some energy into. But, you know, just to answer your question, Abby, I think it's very demonstrative of how much mentality has shifted.
Yeah.
Right. So if mentality shifts in cannabis, you could see it go the other way as well.
Yeah. I mean, of course. But sorry, I was just going to say that, mm-hmm. that makes a lot of sense for the companies that you mentioned. But Shopify is an interesting one. So looking forward to hearing that.
Okay. Two last things as we kind of round out here. The first one is THCO. So I talked the last episode about the Farm Bill and how we could see some regulation around Delta 8 and how Delta 8 has gone out of control and it's also become Delta 9 and THCO and HHC. Well, there's a lawyer, his name is Rod Kite, and he wrote a letter to the DEA and he asked the question, is THCO legal, right? Similar to Delta 8, is THCO legal? Now, it's a little bit confusing because when they spell it out, it's actually called Delta 8 THCO, Delta 9 THCO, okay? But it's specifically referring to what they call THCO, not referring to what they call Delta 8, right? And the DEA replied, they sent him a letter, and they said, look, THCO is synthetic, meaning it's not naturally found in the hemp plant. Therefore, it's not protected by the Farm Bill. Therefore, it's a Schedule I drug under law. Okay?
Okay.
And this is really interesting because it means that all of the, you know, Delta 8 hemp CBD stores who are selling THCO are breaking the law. And it is a Schedule I drug. And there really was no clarity on this until he got this response. And the funny thing is, I want to give a shout out to this guy, you know, Rod Kite, because he actually just did the work. You know, there's all this theorizing about it, but he actually just wrote the DEA a letter, followed up, and got a response. And I've seen like a million people, you know, summarize his findings and post it. But it's just such a good metaphor for how investing and life works, which is that people are willing to write articles and you know, theorize on stuff, but so few people are actually willing to go do the work and actually just ask the question, right? So I think that was really, really telling. So what I'm getting out of this is that THCO and HHC, which are, I don't think HHC is naturally occurring, those are not considered legal, but Delta 8 and Delta 9, because they are naturally occurring in the plant, are not considered Schedule 1, right? So really interesting outcome, and big shout out to Rod Kite for doing the work. And to close that point, one thing I've been kind of reconsidering is I think there's actually so few people doing fundamental analysis on like even big tech companies. I'm starting to think that you can actually have an edge in markets if you're willing to do fundamental analysis. Now, the hard part is you have to actually try to understand the business, which is a lot harder than it sounds. But I think so much of investing is actually momentum-driven trading and is actually, you know, done based on narrative. Case in point was, you know, Meta. But I think actually I'm changing my mindset that if you are willing to dig in and do the work, you might be able to actually do fundamental valuation-based investing and come out ahead because so few people are actually doing it and guiding their investment decisions on it. Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. That's, I mean, it makes a lot of sense. On the tech side, I think it's, I don't know, man. You're going to be dealing with a lot of institutional capital. You're gonna be dealing with like a lot of very smart people who've put a lot of time into it. But hey, listen, if it proves out your thesis that okay, like, you know, just going through and looking at the company as opposed to just relying on momentum or sentiment gives you an edge. I mean, you know, I'd be interested to see what you come back with, because I do agree with you. Fundamental analysis is absolutely important, but you know, just given sort of my career and what I've sort of seen on the street and everything, I really think it's more top-down and sentiment-driven more than anything, right? But hold on. But having said that, I've never lived through a recession. Or like I have lived through, but I've never worked through a recession.
Well. So exactly. So that's a great point, right? Is for the last 10 years, fundamental analysis and underwriting and valuation has worked against you, especially in the technology space, because companies that had negative fundamentals, they were able to go to the well and get capital and keep growing, right? And the fundamental way of underwriting companies like Facebook was not correct, because those companies actually did achieve massive scale and achieve massively profitable monetization, right? But now I think what's happening is a lot of companies have reached peak profitability in 22. They're going to have a headwind going against them when it comes to earnings. And I think there's a whole generation of investors, including institutional investors, who I think are more retail than people want to think, who have been trained on momentum investing, right? And sentiment-driven investing and narrative-driven investing. So I think if that changes as capital gets tighter, which, you know, look, right now is not happening, but again, I think it will change. And that's part of what I'm saying about disrupting investor psychology. I think that's a big thing of what's going to change. And that's where I'm kind of looking at it and saying, hey, fundamentals, just because it hasn't mattered for 10 years, it might start to matter again, right? And that's where I'm kind of peeking my head out and saying, I've learned a lot of these skills reading these, you know, crazy, you know, OTC listed cannabis company financials. You know, when I dug in and read the financials of Meta, I was positively surprised by like, oh, these are actually easier to read. These companies actually read a lot cleaner than the cannabis companies.
Yeah.
Right. So that's something I'm gonna work on. So we'll see.
Awesome. But
to close out the episode, when it comes to the disruption of investor psychology, so first of all, I think that the rally that we've seen overall just shows you that, you know, you have to stay humble, and this is why you have to stay invested. You know, you can trade around the core and you can adjust offense and defense, but you don't go 100% to cash and you don't, you know, be 100% all in invested, because you never really know what's going to happen in markets, right? And markets bounce and find bottoms and go up for really reasons that are extraordinarily difficult to predict, right? And you can get sucked into this game of thinking that you're an amazing trader and you're going to try to time every top and bottom, but it's just not realistic, right? At times where you see value and you see opportunity, you put money in. And at times where you see frothiness and overvaluation, you take a step back.
Oh, I was going to say you put more money in.
Yeah, exactly. Then you really go for it.
Yeah, yeah.
Which has been the mentality for a while, and we're in a different world now, right? So what I go back to is this idea of patience and conviction. So first of all, on conviction, that was something I got wrong in 2020 when I was bearish, but then I didn't pay attention to what was going on around me. And so you have to keep looking at the data, right? You can't just stick your head in the sand and say, I'm right, and, you know, kind of plow forward, right? So you have some, you got to stay invested more.
Well, I mean, in to your defense, in 2020, like, that was unprecedented, and nobody assumed that there was going to be that much stimulus printed that quickly, right?
So, but once it was, that was the time to pay attention to it, right?
Right.
And in cannabis, it was also, hey, look at the sales, right? Look at the OMMU week by week. Like, sales are strong, right? That's what I missed in 2020. So what I learned was, even you can be high conviction, you have to keep looking at what's happening, right? You can't stick your head in the sand. Mm-hmm. Now, number two is the idea of patience. So what I think about is, in 2021, okay, if you recognize that inflation was happening and you knew that inflation was going to cause the Fed to go the other way and start hiking, historically, a historic amount of rate hikes that have happened in 1 year, you could have said, okay, I'm pulling all my cash out and going to the sidelines, right? You would have avoided a lot of the pain. However, if you look at 2021, we didn't really hit the peak of the market until the very beginning of 2022. So Bill Gurley had a really good study of this. And he said the majority of the gains in venture capital, or in general, are made at the very top of the market. So if you look at it and say, hey, things are getting too frothy, I'm getting completely out of this, you're going to miss out on a lot of the gains.
But it's impossible to time that market, right? It's impossible to time the top.
Well, exactly. But his point is that by pulling all your chips out, saying, hey, it's getting too frothy, I'm going all to cash, you're going to have to sit there. And in the case of the broader market in 2021, you would have had to miss out on 8 to 10 months of incredible gains. And it would have been very hard to sit on your hands and do nothing, right? So the point I'm saying is that you could have been right. You could have been prescient. You could have basically had a crystal ball on inflation and rate hikes. And you would have probably been kicking yourself at all the gains you missed. So the point I'm making is that even when you're right, things take time to play out and you don't know exactly how they're going to play out. So the patience element of it is to say that if you're negative on the macro like I am, and you think that we're about to have a very tough re-rating process and repricing process, sometimes you have to be patient, right? You're not going to go fully to cash because, like we talked about, anything can happen. You never know how markets behave. But even if you're being more defensive, it takes time for investor and consumer mentality to change. And it is a process. And nobody wants the good times to stop. Mm-hmm. So there is an element of patience that I think we're living through right now, where you have to say, look, I'm not going to chase the rallies. I'm going to keep an eye on the data. I'm going to see how things play out and if the labor market really starts to loosen up. But overall, I'm relatively defensive. You know, I'm still kind of hoarding cash in the places where I can, and I'm waiting to see if things change the way I think they'll change before making aggressive moves. All right, guys, that's it. That was a little 2-week update on what's gone on so far and some predictions on what could be important later on this year. CINpodcast@gmail.com. I have been responding to emails the last week, which is new. So please shoot us your thoughts, notes, questions, etc. Until next time.
This podcast is a general communication and entertainment being provided for informational purposes only. It is educational in nature and not designed to be a recommendation for any specific investment product, strategy, plan, feature, or other purposes. Any examples used in this podcast are generic, hypothetical, and for entertainment purposes only. None of Cannabis Investing Network or its affiliates are suggesting that the listener or any other person take a specific course of action or any action at all. Communications such as this are not impartial and are provided in connection with advertising and marketing of products and services. Prior to making any investment or financial decisions, an investor should seek individualized advice from a personal financial, legal, tax, and other professional advisor that take into account all of the particular facts and circumstances for an investor's own situation. By listening to this communication, you agree with the intended purpose described earlier. Opinions and statements of financial market trends that are based on current market conditions constitute our judgment and are subject to change without notice. We believe the information provided here is reliable, but should not be assumed to be accurate or complete. The views and strategies described may not be suitable for all investors.